Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer and musician Gary Bohan Jr., and we're talking about his book, Sharky, When Sea Lions Were Stars of Show Business, 1907 to 1958. Gary, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.
This is a wild story, but it's a story from your family. Talk to me about the connection.
So it's a story from my family. As you say, they were sea lion trainers, my great-grandfather and two of his brothers. And then they got my grandfather, my great-grandfather's son-in-law, into the act. So for about 50 years, this was their career. And I really didn't know too much about it growing up because my family really didn't talk about it. So
Well, stop there. Were they embarrassed by it or they just thought it was too odd?
No, I think that they just didn't think there was that much there.
Wow.
Right. So
it's show business.
And my father knew the most about the story. He grew up with the main character of the book, Sharky the seal and sea lion, those two words somewhat interchangeable at the time. But keep in mind, obviously they didn't have the internet back then, and his father and grandfather would disappear and come back, and my father just didn't make too much of it.
Wow.
So it was very casual.
Well, I'm really glad that you uncovered this story, because it's a funny, bizarre piece of entertainment history. Now, you mentioned sea lion. Sea lions and seals are not the same thing. Now, people call sea lions, and those are the ones that are on the West Coast. We don't have them here on the East Coast.
So sea lions, what we traditionally think of as a trained seal most often is, in fact, a trained California sea lion, and such was
absolutely
the case with my relatives.
Reading this book, I thought I knew animal behavior fairly well, but these sea lions, especially through your relatives' eyes, and we should say Mark Hewling is one of the big names, right?
Yes, Mark Hewling. That was my great-grandfather, and he figures heavily in the book.
These sea lions seem to have an incredible amount of intelligence. Not only that, they seem to have a sense of humor unto themselves and are quite mischievous.
To say the least, yes.
I mean, who knew that sea lions were that wild, that they could actually star in a Broadway show?
Right, and the main character Sharky, in fact, did star on Broadway, which just was one of the many bizarre moments of my research is when I uncovered that. And like you said,
we'll talk a little bit about that later. Okay. But he met with a long list of luminaries. Mm-hmm. He was in television. He was in films. He met the president of the United States.
He did.
He had a better life than I do.
Oh, I know. He worked with sports stars. He worked with Hollywood stars, Broadway stars. Really just covered the gamut.
Well, let's get to the start of this. How did Mark Hewling, at 31, get into SEAL training?
So he was actually, I think he was a little bit younger. His older brother, Frank, I think was 31. Mark was in his mid-20s, and his younger brother, Ray, was, I think, 19 or 20, thereabouts. So they were young men searching for work, and they lived in upstate New York, outside of Buffalo. And it just so happens that one of their family acquaintances was a sea lion trainer. Not only that, a very prominent sea lion
Captain
trainer.
Thomas Webb.
Captain Thomas Webb. So they visited his home, and he offered them jobs as assistants, and they accepted. And as the saying goes, the rest is history. They ended up buying him out a couple of years later, and within a few years, they hit the big time with working with the Ringling Brothers Circus.
That's another interesting part. There's a lot of interesting sub-stories to this book, and one of them is the whole history of circuses. In the United States, because the circuses ended up being consolidated as they were working for them. And so they went through a number of different circuses that they were working for.
That's correct. And so circuses, it's tough to imagine just how big circuses were. Circuses was show business.
That's
how big. And Ringling Brothers operated, in fact, they operated three circuses at the time, and my relatives worked with Forepaugh and Sells, which probably most people haven't heard of. I hadn't heard of them until my research. So Ringling Brothers owned that circus. They owned Ringling Brothers, and they owned Barnum and Bailey. So they all traveled separately when my relatives broke into the business. It wasn't until right after World War I where Ringling Brothers combined with Barnum and Bailey to produce the circus that most of us are familiar with, Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey. So it just fascinates me as well, too. I mean, they were just huge, huge enterprises.
And this was also the time of vaudeville.
Very much so. So my great-grandfather, Mark Hewling, and his brother, Frank, were working Ringling Brothers, and then the younger brother, Ray, ended up working vaudeville, and him and his star sea lion at the time, Charlie, and they were working the biggest vaudeville theaters in the world.
Wow. Well, and they traveled. Mark traveled, I think, to Germany and then Venezuela.
Yep.
Frank traveled to New Zealand and Australia.
Yes. Yep. He did, and not only did he travel there, he received rave reviews, received accolades. They made postcards. In fact, I'm looking at a postcard right now of Frank in New Zealand. And I started my research in 2016. So one of the things I was doing, of course, I'm constantly Googling the internet, seeing what's out there. All of a sudden, I started getting all these hits for Frank Hewling. Well, it was newspapers, 100 years ago today, type of thing, reminisces, and they were talking about Frank Hewling and a sea lion starring in Australia and New Zealand. So 100 years later, it was in the news.
Now, what was Hewling's barn?
Hewling, so my great-grandfather Mark Hewling got out of the business in 1929. And as had his brother Frank, by 1929, they were both out of the business. And he opened up a nightclub called Hewling's Barn. So that Mark was actually involved. He had operated a miniature golf course for a couple of years, but then opened up this nightclub called Hewling's Barn.
That was another whole side story in this book. Right? There's a whole history of miniature golf courses. He was in on the beginning of it.
That's right. There was actually, I mean, this is, again, it seemed like every stone unturned, revealed this quirky piece of history, and that was no exception. There are actually, believe it or not, there are miniature golf historians out there, and they will tell you that right after the stock market crash, there was a miniature golf craze that lasted a couple years.
And your relative was in on it.
Got right in on it, yeah.
But then vaudeville died. But what was interesting is, who's Captain George McGuire?
So George McGuire, now we're into the 1930s, and the only brother left is Ray of the three.
Yeah.
And then he retired. And then my great-grandfather Mark sold his nightclub, sold Hewling's Barn, and took that money and got back into the train seal business. And he called upon his good friend, Captain McGuire. So Captain McGuire was based out of California, and he was a sea lion catcher. And
it looks good on your resume. Well, first of all, I love there's photographs, obviously, in this book. I love the way he looks. He looks like a classic, when you think about it, a seagoing guy.
Doesn't he?
Yeah, he looks like Captain Bob that we used to have doing the art shows around here.
Oh, and yeah, I know the shot you're talking about, and it's a great shot.
Now, how did he capture seals?
So he would go out. He had a couple of assistants, a couple of trusty assistants, and they'd go out into the islands off of California, Santa Cruz, for example, and there'd be rocky coves with literally thousands of California sea lions. And Captain George McGuire fancied himself a talent scout. He really did. So he had certain metrics. He preferred barkers. There was the width of a seal's nose or the arc of his nose that apparently was another metric of intelligence. And he would gaze out into the cove, and he had with him a very long net, and his assistants would be in a rowboat, and he'd single out a sea lion, and the assistants would round up the sea lion, and McGuire would bring him back ashore.
Now, Sharky was caught by Captain George McGuire. Sharky was a runt.
He was. He was the runt of the that one trip. McGuire got six sea lions for Mark Ewling in 1938 when Mark was getting back into the business. And Sharky was such a runt, which is all part of the, to me, the appeal of the story.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he was the runt, and Mark almost almost returned him, because he was that small and unspectacular. But, of course, in true fairy tale fashion, Sharky, once in the water, displayed all these talents that McGuire had obviously seen, and was also quite a comedian. So much so, I mean, as you suggested earlier on, the sea lions all had their own personality.
It's really true. Like, the more you have to read this book to really understand that. It amazed me.
It really, and me as well. And so it was one thing Mark was able to do, and his brothers, was really tease out the personalities of the sea lions and treat them very individually, very, very kindly. That's another theme of the book. And let them foster their abilities. In the case of Sharky, fostered his comic sensibilities, and let the sea lion do its thing.
And they were jealous of each other, depending upon who was getting attention.
Oh, right. It's, as Mark said, the only thing worse than not being able to show off, a sea lion not being able to show off, was watching another sea lion show off.
Now we come to an amazing thing, Seal College. Where was it?
So Seal College was right in the town I grew up in Kingston, New York. And I must have driven by. Now, the building was raised in the 1960s, so it was gone by the time I came of age. And growing up with my family, I must have driven by that building, hundreds of times. You think my dad would have mentioned just once?
Yeah.
But no, it was as you inquired earlier on, it wasn't like it was embarrassed or this. Yeah, it was just like it was just such a nothing burger, he didn't think anything of it. But come to find out that when Mark Ewling got back into the business in the late 30s, he built this huge facility and came up with this hook that the press just fell in love with. It was Seal College. So he would get these sea lions from Captain George McGuire from California, would put them through school and college, and they would come out college graduates.
With a diploma.
With a diploma, yes, between, in their mouths. And the press ate it up.
Now, how difficult was it to train these sea lions?
Well, I think, I don't know firsthand, but I know in terms of, for most sea lions, it did take a couple years to fully train them, but I think it was really a matter of, based on the writings of Mark Ewling, it was a matter of fostering a relationship and demonstrating a lot of kindness, and they would show them respect. The seals would show them kindness in return, and once Mark had established that bond, I think the training came rather quickly after that. So it was really the first and foremost step was establishing a strong bond between the animals and finding out where their abilities and skills lied.
Could the public visit Seal College?
Absolutely. The public, and I've heard from so many people that tell me stories of themselves growing up and as kids, visiting Seal College. So it was really, there would be school teachers would bring classes, elementary school classes there to watch the seals in training. There'd be shows that would be put on. So inside this college, which had dormitories, it had a full kitchen, it had a stage, it had a pool. And on the facade was, in big bold letters, Seal College. So you know, you could imagine we're going to Field College today, kid. But in fact, that's what happened. And I love hearing those stories from people now. Wow. A lot of them in their 80s, for example. And yeah, they remember vividly and fondly.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer and musician Gary Bohan Jr. And we're talking about his book, which is an amazing read. Sharky, When Sea Lions Were Stars of Show Business, 1907 to 1958. Now, how quickly did it become apparent that Sharky was a star?
As soon as, you know, Mark initially dismissed him as a runt, but as soon as Sharky got in the pool and started demonstrating his aquatic abilities, and then he spontaneously broke into a comedy routine, if you can believe that, that all happened within about a month. And
wow.
It was within 6 months, Mark says in his writings, within 6 months, Sharky was head and shoulders above any other sea lion he had ever trained. And that would remain the case for the rest of Mark's career. Sharky was truly was a standout.
Now, he did radio, which today
did.
Sounds a little bit weird. That, yeah, how do I know that's a real seal on the radio?
Yeah, he did radio, as did his predecessor, Charlie. Now, Charlie actually taught himself to sing, which is a whole other story.
Oh, my God.
He sang with an orchestra, in fact. Charlie did a duet with a cellist with an orchestral backing behind him.
This is all so surreal.
Exactly. And Sharky, on the other hand, Sharky had a music feature. It's an old Irish tune called "Where the River Shannon Flows," and
yep.
That was his music feature on the radio and later on and on TV.
Now there's a ton of stories, and we have no way we'd be talking for hours to relate everything that goes on in this book. But one of them that just blew my mind is how Sharky ended up on Broadway. There's the whole story of the play. Which, even without Sharky, that's a whole weird story.
Isn't it? So the play, and I won't give too much away because it's one crazy turn after the other. And Sharky, like you say, is just one cog in this seemingly, you know, you're just wondering, how is this play going to make it to Broadway? Everything seems to be going wrong.
Whoa, and even the title, they sort of came up to it late in the game.
Exactly.
It was called Higher and Higher.
Higher and Higher, written by none other than Richard Rodgers.
I know.
And Lorenz Hart. So, you know, at the time, this was 1940, Rodgers and Hart were the biggest things on Broadway.
Oh my God.
I mean, they were doing two and three Broadway shows a year.
And it starred Jack Haley, who, people, if you don't know the name now, he was the Tin Woodman in the Wizard of Oz movie.
Correct. Yeah, so it starred Jack Haley, and Oz was still in first-run theaters. So it was Haley's next project after he had filmed The Wizard of Oz.
There's a whole long story, and people have to read the book about even just getting this off the ground.
Right, and how it came to be. It's just through happenstance. It's, you know, I've got... As I'm sure you noted, I've got literally hundreds of endnotes at the end of the book, and one of the reasons I did this is people are going to think I'm making this up.
I know. It seemed like it was a script for a movie. That, you know what I'm saying? Your description looked like it was for a movie, actual event.
So I knew somewhat early on in my research that he had been on Broadway and it was Rodgers and Hart. I'm thinking, all right, so that's pretty cool. That'll be nice to include in my book. And as I'm doing the research, I'm thinking, it ended up being two full chapters of my book because it was, like you say, it was so surreal. And there were I was laughing out loud just doing the research.
It was weird. First of all, I think the strangest thing above all is Sharky saved the show.
Yeah, and that was a prediction.
See, that's why it really does sound like a movie. Sharky's presence and his performance in this Rodgers and Hart musical.
No, right. So you had the biggest names
And if it wasn't for Sharky, this would have been nothing.
Right, and so you've got, and you know, again, without giving too much away, Sharky was kind of thrust onto the scene, and the other stars were not only Jack Kelly but Shirley Ross. She's done a whole bunch of pictures with Bob Hope and Bing Crosby, and Marta Egert was a big Hungarian operetta star from Europe, and some of it was the biggest names in stagecraft. Josh Logan.
Oh, wow.
You know, who ended up winning the Pulitzer Prize later on.
Sharky does a lot of poking in Jack Haley's rear end.
Well, that's how, you know, that was one of his special.
I've got to ask you, did you read anything? Did the human actors resent Sharky because he ended up upstaging all of them?
No. And that's, I've had that question asked of me. In fact, I contacted, in order to research the book, I contacted Marta Egert's son, and asked if she had ever shared any memories of Sharky, and he was very quick to say, oh, how much she loved Sharky, and Sharky was such a good colleague, and she considered him human, and this, that, and the other thing. So,
Wow.
No, they really, there was, no. I think once, the rule is, you know, you're working with an animal, especially Sharky. You're working with Sharky, you don't stand a chance.
Now, there's a crazy subplot here, too. And I have to talk about this. Sharky's kidnapped.
Wouldn't you know it? And for our listeners here in the Worcester area, he was kidnapped in Boston during tryouts.
And, so, and there's all this weird going on. It was by Harvard University?
Yeah.
Was it members of the Lampoon staff?
That's right. The Lampoon Club. And so that was, you know, I stumbled onto that, and at first I'm thinking, all right, well, I got one little story. I don't know if I can, is this a hoax? But I ended up with, it was in like three different people's memoirs. I had articles from the Boston Globe, the New York Times printed a story, and the Harvard Crimson, which is, there's student newspapers still exist to this day. I mean, I found stories everywhere.
For me, the weirdest thing of this very weird incident was that there was a rumor involving Ann Sheridan, the oomph girl.
Right, that maybe because the Lampoon had been making fun of Ann Sheridan.
Okay, yeah.
And called her, I think they called her, the month before, they called her the least likely to succeed. So it was a spat.
But there was this weird rumor that she was involved in the kidnapping of Sharky.
Right, that one of her operatives, as retribution to the Harvard Lampoon, had gotten people from the Harvard Lampoon to, or had gotten others from Harvard to kidnap the SEAL as retribution to embarrass the Harvard Lampoon. So there's that story's out there. I mean,
And there's an end chase scene that is perfectly cinematic.
Right. It's like something out of Keystone Cops. You know, they finally, Sharky ends up in this dormitory room at Harvard University. The animal league comes to get him. And just like you say, like something, you couldn't have scripted it any better. On Sharky's way out the door, he breaks his leash and starts dashing under all these parked cars. Oh, you got the street is lined with students out watching the festivities. You've got the three people from the Animal League. They're chasing them like something out of the Keystone Cops, and they can't get. They finally get them, and you just can't make this stuff up.
That needs to be made into a movie.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely,
there are so many stories about this Broadway, and that's only. First of all, realize this is only one thing that Sharky was involved in.
Right, right. So,
but there's a great story about a French woman and the French word for seal.
Well, yes. So
and you need to know that the French word for seal is fouque, P-H-O-Q-U-E, and therein lies a story that you need to find out for yourself by reading this book.
Yes, right, the French, right. So it sounds very similar to
wow.
You know, a four-letter word which cannot be said.
I can't imagine what it was like writing this book.
It was a lot of work, but it was so much fun. And I wrote most of it early in the morning.
I can see.
And
it's also a history that needs to be sort of brought to the surface again. I mean, people don't understand what entertainment was about in the early part of the 20th century, right up and through the 50s. And that brings me, let's talk about Sharkey's last days. How long did Sharkey live?
So Sharkey lived into his early 20s, 23 or 24, which is pretty common for a sea lion in captivity. They actually live a little bit longer in captivity because they don't have to fend off their natural predator.
Oh, yeah, sharks.
Yep.
Yeah.
So.
But he was cared for by his...
He was, yeah. He was cared for throughout his entire life.
Is he buried anyway?
He is. He's buried in my hometown. And as is his predecessor, the other star of the book, Charlie, they're both buried in my hometown. In the case of Charlie, there's actually a grave marker that stands to this day in his honor.
But there's not one for Sharkey?
There was, but the building got raised. And with that, so did the marker.
Do you think you could start a movement to get a marker to honor Sharkey?
Yeah, I've thought about that.
In all seriousness, because, he's a major figure in entertainment.
Yep, absolutely. So, if there is a historical commission in my hometown, and I've met some of those people over the past several months, so ultimately I would like some sort of permanent remembrance.
Now, if you're listening to this, you may find it hard to believe, but we've just scratched the surface of the story of Sharkey. There's an awful lot in this book that's just wild, including meeting the president. My guest tonight has been writer and musician Gary Bohan Jr., and we've been talking about his book. It is really worth a read. Sharkey, When Sea Lions Were Stars of Show Business, 1907 to 1958. Gary, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, Mark, for having me.
You listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.